I've made this standard disclaimer before, but I want to do it one more time this morning. We don't really talk at the effect about politics, about current events so much, about national macro items, and there's a couple of reasons for that. And one of the reasons is that it's not that we don't have an opinion about those things. I don't have an opinion about those things, but it's that my opinion is just as good as yours. You know, it's not like God's whispering in my ear who to vote for or anything like that. And so it's just kind of irrelevant to what we're doing here in terms of trying to imply any sort of endorsement or any sort of thing. In fact, it's kind of like an actor. Once you know too much about them, it's kind of hard to watch them in a movie again. I think it's like that. So the less you know, the better about those things. But on the other hand, there's another reason that we do this, is because we truly believe that Jesus was moving us from a macro, from a group-centered approach to spirituality through religion, to a micro, to an individual one-on-one relationship point of view and focus. And he was doing it deliberately, because at the time that he came on the scene as a public minister, Judaism had moved into a completely legalistic and group-centered, law-driven system. And it had lost its heart, it had lost its soul, it had lost its way. The people had become separated from God because they had to move through these lawyers called Pharisees and scribes and through this temple system before they could even hope to approach their God. And Jesus was violently opposed to that. He was trying to move them back, to take out the middlemen, to move them back to this one-on-one understanding where everything changes. Because as we said in here before, in the group, the highest good is justice. Without justice, you lose the group. But in the micro, in one-on-one relationships, if all you're doing is balancing scales, then you're losing what it means to be in relationship in the first place. You become intolerant. You become inflexible. You become uncompassionate, unmerciful. And so in the micro, the greatest good is compassion and mercy. And so Jesus was moving us that way. And so for those two reasons, since this community is based in learning to live the effect of God's love, trying to affect true transformation, true recovery, Jesus said that that starts inside, that the kingdom isn't out there someplace to be discovered. It's within us. It's among us. It's in our midst. It's all those things at the same time. And so that's where we focus. But on a day like today, we can't help but move into the macro. On the 10th anniversary of 9/11 and the attacks that occurred in New York and Washington, D.C., we can't help but just take a moment and talk about this, because our country has never been the same and arguably will never be the same again. 9/11 and what happened 10 years ago today changed everything. I mean, is it amazing to you how much life in America has changed, for those of you who are old enough to remember what it was like before? We're so much less free than we were 10 years ago. We're so much more fearful than we were 10 years ago. You have to practically do a striptease to get on an airplane these days. You know, everything has changed. The way we do business and the way we understand our world has all changed. So it's important for us to mark dates like this and to remember things as we go through life. I remember when I was younger, people would always say, I can remember exactly where I was and exactly what I was doing the moment that I heard that President Kennedy was shot. And I was only 7 at the time, so I don't remember much about it. I do remember watching his funeral on the little Aqua 60s TV that we had, black and white. But 9/11 is like that. It was such an incredible, seminal event, such an indelible event, as you probably remember exactly where you were when you first heard the news or first realized what was happening. I know I do. I remember being woken out of sleep at about 6 or 6:30 in the morning by the telephone ringing and, you know, stumbling over to pick it up. And it's my friend George, who lived in Chicago, calling me. And he was all breathless and hyperventilating. He said, turn on the TV, turn on the TV. And I remember saying, what channel? He said, any channel. And so I turned on the TV, and I'm holding the phone in one hand, and I'm rubbing my eyes with the other as the screen kind of dissolves into focus, and I'm seeing this aerial view of the Twin Towers, you know, from the north face of the North Tower, and this black smoke billowing out. And I remember thinking how incredibly blue the sky was behind that smoke. It was almost like a mockingly beautiful day that day, just crystal clear. And here's this smoke billowing out. And as I'm watching this and I'm trying to kind of comprehend what's going on, suddenly out of the right frame of the screen, I see this blip just fly across and this huge fireball erupt. And I couldn't quite comprehend what it was that I was seeing because I hadn't gotten any other information. I didn't know what was going on. And to see that plane and not even totally realize it was a plane, it's like, what is happening? What is going on? And when the full impact started to set in, I remember I had no words. There was, you know, Marion and I are just looking at each other, and it's just like, how do you process this? How do you understand? You know, watching these things burn, hearing the commentators struggling for words themselves, trying to find a way to credibly deliver, convey what is going on in the midst of everything that they're feeling at the same time. And then to watch those towers just implode, pancakes just fall the way they did, knowing how many people were inside, watching the people jumping from them. I mean, the whole thing was just completely surreal. There was no real way to process it in real time. I couldn't believe that what my eyes were telling me was actually happening. And I don't know how it came across to you, but I can still remember. I can put myself into that place. And if I watch film clips like I did last night, of that scene again. It just brought it all back as if I were watching it for the first time. And then yesterday morning, getting up and watching the memorial ceremony at Shanksville, the field in Pennsylvania where Flight 93 went down. And there's former President Bush and Laura and former President Clinton and Vice President Biden and this incredible array of dignitaries. And they're talking and a poet comes on and he speaks eloquently. I think I was most moved by the just the little naval contingent there that was providing the colors and one female sailor in this crisp white uniform singing the Star Spangled Banner just flawlessly. And it gave me a certain sense that our nation is still together. We're still standing. There's still this, I don't know, this core that wasn't touched completely by 9/11. And then we got up and we started getting ready because we were going to our own 9/11 memorial service ceremony in Rancho Santa Margarita. Never would have gone except that my son is a Cub Scout now. And so the Cub Scout troops were all there in force. I had no idea what to expect. I didn't even know Rancho Santa Margarita had a city hall. I mean, you know, they got a city hall. It's beautiful with a big park behind it and the library across the street. And we get there, and the first thing that we see is nothing but Marines. Marines are everywhere, and they're in their desert fatigues, you know, and I didn't expect, I guess I didn't know what to expect, but I didn't expect that. And they had these pop-up tents all over the place in the Marine red with the insignia on it. And they had jeeps and armored transports and amphibious vehicles and this huge, you know, treaded vehicle that was a troop transport and their weapons and all these things on display. And the kids are all milling about. There's scouts everywhere and they're uniforms, blue uniforms, khaki uniforms, and people, and there's a scout master who is teaching the Weebelos, the highest of the Cub Scouts, how to raise and lower the flags because they're going to be part of the ceremony and they're going to drop the flags to half staff and all of this activity going on. And it was amazing to walk through and just be a part of all that and see it just going and all these people coming here to try to be connected, to try to remind themselves that they're a part of something larger than themselves, that this nation does exist out there someplace. Sometimes it just seems so abstract, doesn't it? Washington is this place way out there, and how does this thing work? Does it work? Most of the time, I think we ask. And here it was working. And they gathered us all to the central area, and the mayor of Rancho was there to address and MC and give an opening address, and there's a bunch of people sitting in chairs, and we were standing in the back with all the scouts. But the thing that was impressing me the most was the contingent of Marines that were there from the 2nd Battalion, 5th Regiment. They called them the 2-5s. I had to go online and find out a little bit more about them because I was so impressed with them. And they're the most decorated battalion in the most decorated regiment in the Marines of all time. You know what their motto is? It's retreat hell. And that comes from World War I. Only a couple years after the battalion was formed, they were sent to France to fight and die in the trenches. And one young officer, when he was told to retreat, said, "Retreat? Hell, we just got here." And so that's their motto. And it was just amazing to watch them with their uniforms just so, you know, crisp and perfect. And they lined up in formation. And when the Star-Spangled Banner was sung, you know, snapping to attention and the salutes. And then their leader spinning around and bringing them at ease with their arms behind their backs and turning on his heel, and the precision, you know, the pride. It was just amazing to watch, to be a part of that, to realize this is part of our nation. This is who we really are. There were three people who died either in the attacks at 9/11 or in theaters of battle in Iraq, Afghanistan, or Pakistan from Rancho Santa Margarita, and they had their pictures blown up in the front. And the parents were there of one of the young men who died in Pakistan, and they spoke. And the veterans of foreign war were there, and they did a 21-gun salute, minus a few guns. Usually it's a squad of seven gunners that shoot three rounds, and they had only four. But I'll tell you, when those rounds went off, everybody jumped and babies started crying. It was loud. It startled everyone except those Marines. They never moved a muscle the entire time. And there was a bagpiper. He played "God Bless America," which I've never heard on a bagpipe before. Didn't quite work. But "Amazing Grace," oh my, brings you to tears to hear that lonely sound out there playing that song. And of course, then he had to play the Marine battle hymn. Their commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Perry, was there to address. It was just an amazing connection for me to watch all this, to be a part of it. And even though I told you at the beginning of all this that we believe that the connection comes from within, and it does, ultimately, if we aren't connected internally with each other, we're never going to be connected externally in our group. But it can go the other way, too. When we allow ourselves to move in and be part of the group, to be connected in the macro, to realize that we are part of this bigger thing, it can move inward and inform us of who we really are. That we're not separate people running around here trying to scratch out a living, scratch out a moment of contentment, just enough to get us through another 24 hours or 12 hours. That there's something larger going on here. And that what was hitting me this whole time. And I think that's something that we need to really look at, re-examine in our lives, is the connection that we feel with each other at all these different levels. And to realize that these connections can work in both ways, reinforce each other, and to bring us to an understanding of what's really going on. Sometimes these connections with our nation, with our military, with our church even, or with our work, all of these connections at all these different levels can help us to understand how we are connected so intimately and point us toward the way that Jesus is talking about. Last week we were talking about meaning and purpose. We were talking about meaning in the context of who am I, remember? We're talking about purpose in the context of why am I here? And if we can't answer these two questions as human beings, we're going to have a compromised life. We're going to be living in some sort of fear. If you don't know who you are or why you're here, your life is constantly a crapshoot. There is no repeatable results for you because you're just blowing, trying to find something that works. We talked about the fact that the meaning of life is one thing, like Curly said in City Slickers. If you just stick to that, then everything else fades into the background. One thing. What is that one thing we all want to know? Well, that's what you got to figure out. You can't be told what the one thing is. You have to live your way through it. And then you will know that you know what that is. The Hebrews called God Alaha or Eloah, which simply means unity, oneness. It's an implied connection. It's an implied acceptance. It's love. God is those things. He is love, acceptance, unity, redemption, deliverance, salvation. He is those things. And his creation is made of that stuff. What else would it be made of but who he is? Literally, all of creation, everything that we observe, is made of the stuff of God. Underlying it is that unity of God. It's infused with his spirit. When we start to experience the connection with each other in these moments, macro, micro, whatever they are, we are starting to learn more and more about who our Father is and who we are in our Father, because we can't understand who we are if it's not in relation to who he is, in relation to this ultimate reality that remains unseen by our senses, but can be intimately experienced by our spirit. This is what this is about. We are made of the same stuff as God, and we will never find our meaning and purpose until we realize that, recognize that, and begin to live it. Live who we are. Live this unity. And the spiritual journey is literally nothing else than remembering who we are. You know, if the poet Wordsworth was right that we come into this life trailing clouds of glory, that we knew who we were when we started and we forget somehow in the course of being born into this life, I don't know if that's true. But it's a remembering of who we are, or a finding out who we are. That is at the core of what this journey is about. That's at the core of what Jesus' way is about. And everything that he taught us, everything that he said, all those red words in the New Testament are about this way of finding out who we are and why we're here, so that we can then take on the abundant life that he was trying to give us. To be set free, to know that truth that makes us free. And it sounds simple, doesn't it? It sounds like, oh, it also sounds a little bit too good to be true. I recognize that as well. But it seems like once you could get that idea in your head, it would be easy to accept, because isn't it easier than the alternative? But you know what? We're complicated people as human beings. The opening line of the novel Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy is very instructive in terms of this, I think. And you probably all haven't read it or have it on your bookshelf, but it's very simple. He writes, "Happy families are all alike. Unhappy families are each unhappy in their own way." Think about that for a second. Happy families are based in love. Love has a sameness to it. It looks the same in all the different places and contexts in which you can place it, because it's based on the same principles. It's based on acceptance. It's based on connection. It's based on other-centered caring for each other. It looks the same. But if you're miserable, you can be as unique as you want to be. And you are. Your misery is your misery, formed in the furnace of your own life and experience and traumas and betrayals and all the things that you fear. Those are uniquely yours. But when you cross over into the territory of love and happiness, you start to look alike. And there's something in us that does not want that. It's like Dante's Lucifer saying, "It's better to rule in hell than serve in heaven." Heard that one before? There's something in us that clings to our uniqueness, clings to our angst and our misery, because at least it's ours and nobody can take it from us, you know? And I don't want to be one of those mind-numb robots that kind of marches into church and marches back out again and sings the songs. I hear this all the time. You know, I really don't think I'm ready to be a Christian because there's too many things that I don't want to give up yet. As if those things that you're afraid to give up would have any relevance if you really crossed over into living a life that was really based in love. But we don't know that yet, do we? And so we cling on to these things. We cling on to our misery. We hold on and think that this is what keeps us head and shoulders above the crowd. This is what keeps us ourselves. And we have gotten to the point in our lives where our identity, who we think we are, is tied up in this dysfunction, tied up in this angst. And we don't want to lose it because we think we'll be losing who we are. We're afraid of all the things we won't be able to do if we start really following Jesus. I had a friend who said that exactly that. I don't know if I'm ready to follow Jesus because, you know, I still want to be able to go out and buy the clothes I want to buy without feeling guilty about it, you know, and buy those clothes. And some people tell me I dress too young for myself, but you know, that's my right. That's my freedom. And if I become a Christian, do I have to give that up? And I said, well, think about the reason that you want to buy those clothes. Why do you need to have those kind of clothes? Why do you need to dress maybe younger than you are or more revealing than you think is that modest Christian modesty would impose upon you? It's because you need the acceptance. You need the attention, don't you? You're walking through life insecure enough that even glances from the opposite sex at least gives you a sense of that something's still going on here, you know? And you fear aging just a little bit less because we're all deathly afraid of aging, aren't we? And so really, think about it. The freedom that we think we have to do those things is really being enslaved to the compulsion of needing the acceptance because of the fear, because you don't know what true love really is. You don't know what unconditional, perfect love really is. And so running around doing these things. Or someone else said, you know, this command to love everybody that I don't like, loving my enemies, I don't know if I'm ready for that. That just sounds like such a burden I'd have to carry around all the time. Imagine if you could rewire your desire so that you truly desired what God desires, that you took pleasure in the things that God takes pleasure in. In what way are you still obeying God's command if you are just as excited about loving the enemy as he is? In what way is that a restriction? The freedoms that we think we have are really the restrictions in our life. They point to the compulsions that underlie our fear. And the restrictions that we fear are the things that really open us up to the freedom of being able to do exactly what we want to do, need to do, at any given time. The things that we do to try to assert our identity, our meaning, our purpose, is exactly the things that keep us from it. It's so hard to get that until you start to experience just a little bit more. These things keep us separated from each other, keep us from the definition, the essence of who God is. As long as we're separated, we can't go for unity while being separated. We have to allow ourselves to melt into, immerse in the unity of God. And when we can let go, when we can fall into the embrace of that unity, well, what is that going to look like? You ever wonder that? What would it look like if you really did these things? Well, fortunately, Jesus told us exactly what it looks like. Right in Matthew 5, and it's in your bulletins if you want to take a look. But I just want to go through these quickly. This is the portrait of what this kingdom resident looks like. Jesus is giving us a picture of the finished product of all of his teaching. If you could follow everything that he's telling you, live it out, this is what you would look like. All right? His entire Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, is given in the context of kingdom. This is how you live in kingdom. This is how it works. This is what you have to unlearn. This is what you need to just accept and embrace. And we need to understand that when Jesus talks about kingdom, the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, he's not talking about the heaven of the afterlife. He's talking about the quality of life that we can all have right here and right now if we could practice these principles, if we could be aware of the presence of God in our lives this moment and the connection that we have with each other. That's kingdom to Jesus. And as you look at these, you see, first of all, that I had to use a lot more words to describe what the initial phrase means if we're going to look at it from an Aramaic Hebrew point of view. And some of you have heard me talk about this before. An ancient language like Aramaic or Hebrew had very limited vocabularies, small vocabularies. So each word had to do double, triple, quadruple duty, lots of simultaneous meanings vertically, very small vocabulary this way. And so with a language like Aramaic, a language like Hebrew, there are all these layers of meaning that are happening at the same time. And not only that, since the words are made from the letters in different combinations, the words have kind of a root and pattern system. It's like a tree trunk that branches out, and all of the words and the roots are connected in meaning, and those are all simultaneously in there as well. I tell you that just to let you know that I'm not picking these paraphrases out of the air. They are based in real scholarship. They're based in an understanding of the way these languages worked. For instance, the word here that starts every one of these eight Beatitudes, blessed, is the word tobe in Aramaic. Tobe is related to the root above it, which is taba, which means good. And notice that the two consonants there, the T and the B, the tav and the bet in their alphabet, are the same, which means they're going to be related in meaning. The only thing that's changing are the vowels. You see, taba, good, really means good in the sense of being ripe, being on time, being harmonious, being able to perform to your desired and designed specifications, not good against some sort of standard. And so tobe, which can mean blessed, really means fortunate are you, congratulations to you, happy are you. Why? Because you're right, because you're in the right place at the right time. You're harmonious, you're connecting, all those things. And so this blessed can be translated all different sorts of ways. And this is what we're doing throughout these translations. But here's the problem. When we read something like this first beatitude, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. What does poor in spirit mean to you? We have no idea, just reading those English words, what poor in spirit means. It's funny, I asked a friend what she thought it meant. And what she thought it meant was being poor in spirit was being someone who had a poor spirituality. Someone who was an unbeliever. Or someone who was oppressed or victimized. To her, being poor in spirit was a negative term. It meant someone who had poor spirituality. Unspiritual. Unbelief. How does that equate to someone who's blessed exactly? You know, but she didn't really think it through. It just sat there. In other words, it meant absolutely nothing. Because you've got two contradictory things. Blessed is someone who's an unbeliever. Jesus saying that. Blessed is someone who has poor spirituality. In reality, that phrase there, poor in spirit, is a Hebrew idiom. An idiomatic expression is one that you can't figure out the meaning from the sum of its parts. It's just a meaning that was agreed upon. You know? Meskina ruch. Poor in spirit literally means this. Enriched and complete are those who live with a sense of dependence, vulnerability, gratitude. That's what poor in spirit means. It means someone who's humble. Someone who realizes that they aren't this island on their own, but they're completely interdependent and completely dependent on their God, on nature, and often on other people. And who not only realize that, but they celebrate it. It's okay. It's great to be submitted like a child into that blissful dependence. That's someone who's poor in spirit, that doesn't have that haughty, prideful approach to life, arrogant approach to life. Enriched and complete, instead of blessed, are those who live with a sense of dependence, vulnerability, and gratitude for the reign of God. Or the reign of unity, which is the best way to translate kingdom of heaven, is the same as this. No more, no less. Notice in the English, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, which implies possession, that you can own the kingdom, that you can inherit the kingdom. That's not the sense from the Aramaic. What Jesus is literally saying is when you live this way, when you have this attitude toward life, when you feel the connection of you with everyone else and with your God, you are kingdom. Such as these are kingdom, Jesus said when he pointed to children playing in the street. We are what he's talking about. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Happy are those who long to fill what is lacking in the lives around them. Have you ever thought of being mournful as that? It's not just about crying. It's not just about feeling sad because someone is hurting, but longing to fill what is lacking in the lives around them who are weak and broken from the intensity of this desire. That's an intimate connection. That's being one with. Longing to fill that lack that you see in the other person. For they will hear God's voice and be strengthened and encouraged, and they will see the face of that for which they long. And we think that if we do good over here and we mourn, then we will be comforted over here sometime, maybe in heaven. That's not what the Aramaic sense is. In the Aramaic, it's instantaneous. At the moment that you enter into connection and intimate mournfulness, desiring to fill what is lacking in another person, that is your comfort. The connection is your comfort that you long for and seek in each other. And you must know this. When someone has gone through a real trauma, what words can you say to make it better? What can you do to fix it? You can't do a thing. And anything you do trivializes and hurts more than it helps. But to simply be connected, to be present, is the only comfort that we will ever get. The connection with each other in both directions, because God is at the core of all of that. Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. Fortunate are those who are not arrogant or domineering. A good working definition of gentle. For they will partake in and have their place to stand and live richly. Once again, we don't inherit the earth. You know, best we can do in English, you got to choose one of those many simultaneous meanings, right, in English, because we got a large vocabulary, very precise words. You got to choose one. So we did. But really, to partake in and have a place to stand, to have your place at table, to have your place in the land. The Hebrews always talking about the land, right? Their place in the land, that the land was theirs, intimately tied to the land. That's what this is about. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Healed, another way to translate tobe, blessed, are those who crave and passionately desire a good place with God. They will find it and know that they have found it. Is that a great definition of being satisfied? To find it and know that you have found it. Why? Because you don't have to search anymore. You're satisfied. You're done searching. For the moment right now, it's all you need. It's a perfect moment. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Thriving are those moved to help someone in need. Mercy, again, not just feeling something, feeling sorry for someone, but being moved to actually do something about it. That's mercy in the Aramaic sense, in the Hebrew sense. Thriving are those moved to help someone in need, turning feeling into action. For in doing so, they will experience the comfort they give. All one thing, instantaneous, simultaneous. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Congratulations to those whose innermost passions and desires are free from anything that is false, that diverts from true purpose. They shall see God and God's unity everywhere they look. Once you get practice in this, you realize God is always present. You'll see him under every rock and around every corner. You can't help but see him as you start to practice these things. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Whole and balanced are those who exert themselves, planting health, safety, and understanding in every season, year in and year out. Shalom to the Hebrews that we normally translate peace is not peace as we think of peace, just an absence of conflict. But it's the sum total of the greatest amount of wholeness and healing and wealth and prosperity and connection and unity. All of those things, the greatest amount. So peacemakers are not just those who break up a fight. That's not what this is about. Whole and balanced are those who exert themselves, planting health, safety, and understanding every season, year in and year out. They will discover who they really are. You find your identity in the connection with the others that you meet that you bring peace to, that you leave better than you found. They will discover who they really are and their place in God's family. Can you see the portrait that Jesus is painting here? Do you see what he's trying to do? You see where he's going with this? Each one of these is of a piece. Each one of these. Oh, I forgot the last one, didn't I? Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And that sounds like way off. Where'd that one come from? Well, we have this negative one in face of all the positive ones. If you look at the little note there, the word radap, which is translated here as persecution, also means to pursue. And the word kenuta, righteousness, you know, can also mean righteousness, justice, salvation, or redemption. And so the real context here is forcing us to see a pursuit of redemption, a pursuit of salvation, rather than here persecution for the sake of righteousness. Those Aramaic scholars believe that this is a mistranslation. You know, we report, you decide. But ripe are those pursuing salvation, redemption, rightness, and purity, for the reign of God, the realization of unity is present in their lives. What Jesus is consistently creating here is this picture of someone who can push off, who can let go, who can let go of the fear of losing their own identity, who they think they are, in favor of connecting with the person who's right in their path, immersed in human experience, not afraid of it, not trying to stand apart from it, immersing in it, allowing themselves to be defined by it. Seeing others not as other, but as an extension of themselves, and them, ourselves, as an extension of others. To see that connection, to realize that we're all made of the same stuff, we're all in the same boat, we're all connecting in this way, intimately connected this way. This is the portrait that Jesus is painting for us, that he's trying to get across from us. In this immersion, in this letting go, comes the ultimate release that we're all desiring, the ultimate freedom. If we can just let them go. It's so true that the things that we fear the most is exactly the place in front of, between us and the freedom that we seek. The things that are most afraid of, that we're most afraid of, the things where our buttons can be pushed, that's exactly the place that we need to lean in, face those fears, move through them. They're the places that we will find the release that we're seeking, the freedom that we want, the connection to understand who we are and why we're here. We talked a bit before about one of the things that we fear most is getting old. Except for you, some of you here that are still too young to have that fear installed in you yet, it's coming. Believe me. It's weird to watch your body change in the mirror. It's weird to see that happen. You still feel the same inside. It's like, who is this person staring back at me? My God, I don't know this person. We fear that. We don't want to lose the things that we had, the things that we thought were us. You know, if we could just face that down, if we could grow old gracefully, or grow in any way gracefully, accepting reality as it is handed to us, things change completely. I wanted to read you just this last little piece here. And it's written by a very old person. And he or she, I don't know the sex of the person, writes this. I would never trade my amazing friends, my wonderful life, my loving family for less gray hair or a flatter belly. As I've aged, I've become kinder to myself and less critical of myself. I've become my own friend. I don't chide myself for eating that extra cookie, or for not making my bed, or buying that silly cement gecko that I didn't need, but looks so avant-garde in my patio. I'm entitled to a treat, to be messy, to be extravagant. I've seen too many dear friends leave this world too soon before they understood the great freedom that comes with aging. Whose business is it if I choose to read or play on the computer until 4 a.m. and then sleep till noon? I will dance with myself to those wonderful tunes of the 40s and the 50s, and if I, at the same time, wish to weep over a lost love, I will. And there's no law that a senior must wear flannel to bed. I will walk the beach in a swimsuit that is stretched over a bulging body, and will dive into the waves with abandon if I choose to, despite the pitying glances from the jet set. they too will grow old. I know that I am sometimes forgetful, but there again, some of life is just as well forgotten, and I eventually remember the important things. Sure, over the years, my heart has been broken. How can your heart not break when you lose a loved one, or when your child suffers, or even when somebody's beloved pet gets hit by a car? But broken hearts are what give us strength and understanding and compassion. A heart never broken is pristine but sterile, and will never know the joy of being imperfect. I love that. The joy of being imperfect. I am so blessed to have lived long enough to have my hair turning gray and to have my youthful laughs be forever etched into deep grooves on my face. So many have never laughed, and so many have died before their hair could turn silver. As you get older, it's easier to be positive. You care less about what other people think. I don't question myself anymore. I've earned the right to be wrong. So to answer your question, I like being old. It has set me free. I like the person I have become. I'm not going to live forever. But while I'm still here, I will not waste time lamenting what could have been or worrying about what will be. And I shall eat dessert every day if I feel like it. But if a woman could say that, how free would she be? Huh? It reminds me of the quote from Henry David Thoreau that you're probably familiar with. He said, most men or women lead lives of quiet desperation and go to the grave with a song still in them. How many of us do that? Leading lives of quiet desperation, living the fear of the things that we fear and never breaking through them to accept reality as it is, to find out who we are on the other side of that fear so that the song doesn't lay stillborn inside of us. This is what this is about. The moment we stop trying to be young, to be older, to be smarter, to be funnier, to be more talented, the moment we stop trying to be all the things except who we are at this moment, this perfect moment, this moment that has everything that it needs, is the moment that we are free. It's the moment that we can relax and just be and understand who we are in God's creation. And actually take a first breath as a newborn, born again, transformed, new creature. See why all this language is in the New Testament? It's descriptive of what happens when we can do this. We can take this step. The world since 9/11, as we said, has so changed. We're less free and we're more fearful. Jesus is trying to make us more free and less fearful. And the only way to do that is to move through the fear to the connection that leads behind it, beyond it, taking us right to the heart of the Father. So today, as we remember where our nation has been, and if we can feel the connection again that we felt those first few days after 9/11, 2001, remember when all the banners were on the overpasses and suddenly it didn't mean anything to be Republican or Democrat. We were just Americans for just a few weeks. Remember that? Remember what that felt like? Remember the connection that we had, if only because we had a common enemy? That connection can work deep within us and we can understand, yes, we are one people with different attitudes and tastes and lifestyles, certainly. But if we can see that, connect with each other, we can start to know something about the heart of our Father that will take us into the love that casts out the fear. Let's pray. Yeah. Father, we are grateful that you have preserved us as a nation. We are grateful that even in the face of attacks, we have that core of who we are. We have these young men and women in their crisp uniforms that remind us that there is pride and that there's something worth fighting for, something worth dedicating and even giving lives for. And watching those young men and women taking care of our children and hurting them and making sure they don't fall off their tanks, it just gives us this wonderful juxtaposition that the hand that can ball into a fist and fight is also the hand that can guide and save and caress. We're these complicated people, Father. You know that you made us this way. Help us to move beyond all the fears that we feel and just be able to connect and relax and be exactly who you made us to be. Free, completely free, able to make the choices that give us the pleasure, that give you the pleasure, because we are one. Thank you, Father, for loving us the way you do. Guide us, continue to guide us. Make us strong enough to be able to keep on the path to finding more and more about who you are, in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Let's all stand.